Well, I really appreciate that. I'm very much enjoying meeting all the people who I'm privileged to meet here while I'm here in Australia. I wish I could take you home. So I'd like to start by, I guess, just jumping into the fact that the internet was built without any way of knowing who you're connecting to. And so it had a big architectural hole in it. When you have an architectural hole, it's almost incredible in retrospect, isn't it, that we would have had an internet with no way of who you're talking to and not really have worried about that when we were designing it. But, you know, boys will be boys, and that's what happens. And what happens when you have a huge architectural hole? You end up with everybody who is living inside that architecture having to compensate for the lack of an architecture. So the way they do that is they go, gee, well, I can do something which will be a workaround and it'll work fine. And you know, I saw what you were doing, but I'm going to be a little more clever than you are, and I'm going to do it this way because it's better and it'll differentiate me and so on. And before long, you end up with, as we did in the internet, what I would call a patchwork of identity experiences, each of which is different from the next. And the result is that the user who is employing the internet has no way of knowing what they should expect as an identity experience in any particular part of it. So when you first go to a site, you won't be able to predict how that identity system is going to work there, or what you're going to release, or you know what the forms are going to look like, or anything else. And as a result, you sort of develop this, I don't know, let's call it a just a willingness to accept any form at all. And it's no wonder then that people can be fished and farmed and attacked. We've basically given them no alternative. There's no way for them to know what their experience should look like, so any experience probably seems good enough. And the internet is structured and the web browser is structured such that when you go to a site, you're in the hands of the site. Your experience is crafted by the site. So if you go to an evil site, you're in the hands of evil parties and they're crafting your experience. And it's gotten to such a level that basically people will type any kind of a secret they have into any kind of a form that you give them. And one of my experiments at Microsoft, carried out on Microsoft employees only, I'll assure you, which didn't make them any less angry at me, was to set up a site which they thought was useful, where they had to put in their credentials, and then one day just making it not work when they put in their credentials. So what do you think happened? Well, they must be using a different set of credentials, and they would start cycling through all their other username passwords, so I could come away with a perfect list of all their username passwords and then employ those on, you know, the local bank, the credit union that we all use, etc. That's why I'm so wealthy today. So basically we've taught people to do whatever the screen is asking them to do, and they really have no choice whatsoever. So at the same time, the internet has started to be used for real serious electronic commerce. I have a friend, you know, one friend who bought a car over the internet because he thought, gee, that's a great bargain, and in fact it was. I have another friend who bought a house. So we're talking large sums of money now that are exchanging hands on the internet in addition to the normal just massive small transactions. And when there's commerce of any kind, it begins to attract crime, and if the opportunity is big enough, it'll attract organized crime. Well, what better opportunity than a system which is in total chaos and where there are no rules? What better opportunity for organized crime? And it turns out that there are you know, masses of people with PhDs in second and third world countries and no jobs. So it's possible for organized crime to hire really the best minds in the world, or just as good as anybody else's, and put them to work on these problems. So we see a very fast development of the sophistication of the attacks on the computer. One of my more sordid experiences at Microsoft is to be briefed every week on the latest attacks. And, you know, I can guarantee you that there are attacks that come along that no one in this room, no matter how advanced their understanding of computers might be, or how intimate they might be even with the peculiarities of a given operating system, would be able to withstand. So think back 5 years and how concerned you were about internet crime and spam and things like that, and compare it to the way you probably feel now. We now realize spam is a really big problem. If we're not careful, our email will become unusable. On my identity blog, I'll flog my identity blog all through the presentation, so get ready. On my identity blog, but if you forget the name of it, you can just Google for Kim, and I'm in the first 11 there. I have to compete with the Prime Minister of Korea, so sorry. and everybody else in Korea. So, I'm sorry about that.
No one's trying to steal his identity, right?
No, not yet. So, what you end up with is this patchwork of identities that is a perfect target for phishing and farming. So it's a very serious problem, and our view is that, as I said, if you go back 5 years and you think about where we were at, it's growing at an annual compound growth rate of 1,000%. So now go forward 5 years and ask yourself what situation we will be in. And it's clear that, you know, it's an untenable situation. It will lead to a undermining people's confidence in the internet, and an increasing, drop in virtual commerce. Don't worry about the music next door. It's just like my teenage children. So, you know, I'm immune. I won't be discouraged by it. So think of the fact that the actual actual computer industry is only growing at what, 40% a year? And the criminal element is growing, their attacks are growing at 1,000% a year, and you can sort of see what our trajectory is if we don't do anything. There was a recent study done in the U.S. about what is the impact of this on people's willingness to do e-commerce. And what was most interesting was that, you know, although overall use of e-commerce is growing, the amount of e-commerce done by people who've been doing it for a while is decreasing. And in fact, the chances that you will decrease your e-commerce are directly proportional to your experience in computing. So the more you know about computing and the longer you've been doing it, the less you're going to do e-commerce. So I don't read tea leaves, but I do not see this as a good sign. This is eagles falling to the ground on the left. So we need to really start to bring this in and make it what I would argue is that the whole future of the virtual world is at stake here, and the whole question of building e-commerce hinges on us being able to react to the situation. So now I'm going to turn to another question, which is, okay, if we want to actually fill in for this missing layer of the internet in something which is more than an ad hoc way, what would we have to do? And first thing we'd have to understand is, what do we mean by digital identity? So what we mean, in my view, is, and I ask you to just bear with me on this, even though it'll probably sound horrifying for the first 5 minutes, it hurts less after that. A digital identity is a set of claims about that one subject makes about another subject. So what I'm doing is factoring out the question of the believability of the claim. I'm not saying it's not an important question. I'm just saying let's treat that as another question that is ancillary to this first question. So the digital identity is the fact that one subject makes claims about another subject. So I'll give you some examples. It could be, please turn off your cell phone. This is an incredibly precious performance. The example could be Visa making claims that Kim Cameron has $15 to make a purchase. So that's Visa is making the claims. Kim Cameron is the subject. The place that I'm visiting is what we call the relying party for those claims. Notice that I call them claims, and I'm using the notion from the Oxford there that says a claim is an assertion which is in doubt. So the basic point is that, you know, any assertion, especially in a world which is becoming increasingly interconnected and, what should I say, a mesh of cooperating business entities and not some, you know, centrally managed and understood place where we all just salute and know what everything stands for. You have to regard everything as being in doubt, and then you decide about how you're going to respond to these claims based on your risk analysis. So I'll give you an example of that. In the early days, in the early phases of attracting a customer, websites want to, and I've spoken to a lot of them about this, they want to be able to, quote, acquire. That's all they really care about. A new customer comes near them, they want to acquire that customer. What kind of identity statement will they accept at that point in time? Anything. When I'm not in polite company, I say this is the phase of promiscuous identity exchange. So you could call yourself Mickey Mouse, and they'll go, fine, have I got a cape for you, or whatever it is. So later in your relationship with that entity, they're going to want to start to make money with you. Perhaps they're making money just with your eyeballs by selling ads, and therefore they don't care. You can carry on being Mickey Mouse infinitely, and they'll be happy with you. In other cases, they may want to upgrade the nature of that relationship, and they would do that, for example, by trying to get you to spend some money there. At that point, they're going to want a slightly stronger statement of your identity. They're going to want something which allows them to collect money, and so you'll see things like credit card companies coming into the picture and so on. So, in other words, what we use in order to decide whether we're going to do things is always a trust evaluation. It's a calculation. I prefer even the notion of risk reduction to the notion of trust. That's just because I'm such a skeptical person. So it turns out that all of this is very similar to what happens in the brick-and-mortar world. I notice here they call it the real world. The real world includes the virtual world. The brick-and-mortar world is sort of partly real, and the virtual world is partly real, and so on. So in the brick-and-mortar world, you have your wallet, and if you think about what's in your wallet, you have each of your pieces of identification consists of a series of statements about you. And you have different ones that you use in different contexts. Your driver's license says you can drive. It says your name is such and such and so on. But it's really an attestation of the fact that you can drive. Your passport says you're a citizen of Australia. Your visa says you're good for $15. So you have a series of pieces of identity, each of which can be used in a context that you feel comfortable with. And these assertions are being made by different parties. We're very used to this model. This model makes us feel very comfortable. And so one of my propositions is that when we do the technology, the architecture of identity, we want to do it using models that are already widely accepted and not try and change human nature and improve the quality of humans in general while we're deploying the technology. In other words, we want to take advantage of what humans are like and give them models that they're familiar with. So, as you can see, I know a lot about digital identity, and you're probably wondering how I found out. Well, no, that's a joke. Okay, the Microsoft was involved in this initiative called Passport. Passport was, in my view, Passport had two missions. One was to be an identity provider for the internet, and one was to be an identity provider for Microsoft internet properties. And it's really interesting to look at the balance sheet of that experience and say, boy, you know, as an identity provider for the internet, it has zero users. But as an identity provider for MSN, it has 300 million users and a billion logons a day. So you can't say that it was a complete failure. You can say that it was very peculiar and that it was very much a success in one area and a failure in others. And then you have to say, well, why did it succeed in one area and fail in others? And so I've become very interested in this, and I would argue that the same question applies to many other identity technologies. So, for example, we have certificates. Certificates are very successful in terms of providing us with indications of the identity of the websites we're going to. They've also been touted as things that would identify us as individuals. Well, you know, to what extent do you use certificates to identify yourself as an individual in real life? The answer is, you know, that this technology has essentially failed for individual identification, even in spite of its success in the world of identifying public entities like websites. So my takeaway from one of the things I'd like you to take away from my presentation is that this architectural layer must be different from Passport. Passport is not the solution, and so even though I'm from Microsoft, I'm not saying Passport is the solution. I'm saying Passport was a very good learning experience for us, but one of the things it shows us is we need something different than that. And the other thing I'd say is that you're going to see lots of other entities trying to do the types of thing that Passport was trying to do. In other words, other entities trying to be the center of the identity universe. And I think my conclusion will be that anyone who tries to do that will fail. There is no center. So all of this led me to these laws of identity, and I'll just go really fast through these. The essence is that for a system to succeed, users have to want to use it. If the users don't use it, the system will end up in the trash can, in the great IT trash can in the sky. And certainly it's already full to the brim, so it's hard to put anything new into it. So it's essential to bring the user into the equation. The user has been factored out of the identity equation. So when I say user must be in control, I don't mean that the website or the resource provider or the service provider therefore should lie down and allow users to ride roughshod over them and, you know, that all of their rights are lost or anything like that. They always are the people who can establish the bar for what people have to do in order to use their services, okay? But in terms of providing the information that service requires, the user has to be in control of how this works and has to consent to any release of information rather than having it leak out of the system in ways that they don't understand, such that later they come along and are enraged and once again say, oh, let's put this system up in that trash can. And now if you start looking at, okay, how do we make this a robust system that won't be hacked into and won't be an identity catastrophe in waiting, you need to adopt some notions of, for example, putting as little information out into the system as possible, distributing the least amount of information, putting the information in the fewest number of places. The more we can have data reduction, the more we can have data reduction, the more we can we can have a system that is reliable and safe for the user to use, and therefore which leads to this trustworthiness that we were talking about earlier. The third notion is one of justifiable parties. Only parties who should be in a identity relationship and who make sense to the other parties, is a better way of putting it. Only the parties that make sense to the other parties should be a part of that relationship. So if we look at the passport problem, you know, Amazon would say, now what is Microsoft doing in my relationship with my customer? Do I really want Microsoft to know my entire customer base? Maybe one day Microsoft will want to start up microbooks.com. Do I really want them to have my customer list? No. The marketing people say, you know, the sites did not want to be disintermediated. And they're allowed to use that word because they're marketing people. So, you know, similarly, we can look at this thing from the point of view of the individual. The individual would say, what do I want Microsoft doing between me and Amazon? I mean, what are they trying to do? Understand everything about me? And they would say, this is ridiculous. I don't want to get involved. So that's the notion of justifiable parties. And once again, that will apply to any form of identity. I should add that the minimal disclosure for a defined use law also implies that the base type of identity we should be using on the internet is anonymity. In other words, nothing should be released unless there is some reason for it to be released. And so you basically start with that common thinking that we do not release information for no reason, and then we release it when we're required to under specific terms in such a way that we're guaranteed that it won't leak and won't be attackable. Directional identity is a reflection of the fact that identity was basically invented by people like me when we worked for enterprises. So enterprises had computers before individuals had computers. We thought through the identity problem from the point of view of the enterprise, not from the point of view of the individual. One day I walked into a conference where it was a privacy conference, and I walked in as the, you know, a number of people know who I am as the architect of identity at Microsoft, and I had my Bluetooth phone, and it had my name on it. It was broadcasting my name as the phone name. So I walked into this conference, and they actually had triangulating Bluetooth receivers set up throughout the conference, and they were going to track some people at the conference and project it onto a map in one of the conference rooms in order to show the vulnerabilities of Bluetooth. So, of course, when I walked in and they said, oh, there's Kim Cameron, right? Oh, Microsoft. Oh, let's track him. This was like a field day for them. So they were going, oh, this is great. And, of course, I'm the type of person who at a conference goes around and nibbles. I go and look in this room, and I go in and look in that room, and I'm going, well, there must be something interesting here. So I'm poking my nose all over the place until I find something. And, you know, meanwhile, they're down there plotting this in real time, and you see the psychotic movements of this sort of butterfly-like thing, and meanwhile, every 15 minutes I have to run out to the edge of the building to make a telephone call, and so you see these things coming off like this. And at a certain point in time, I nibbled into the room that had the projection of my movements. It was really quite an interesting moment for me, and so one of the advantages of my job is I can bring people in and I can meet with people from different parts of the industry. So I actually phoned up the person who was the head of the Bluetooth Association, and he happened to be visiting. I said, why don't you drop in and see me? And I said, you know, this must be some kind of a mistake, right? Like, what was going on here? Are you fixing Bluetooth so that it doesn't do this? And he said, well, actually, it was really part of the original design philosophy. We thought it would be an excellent use case that you could be walking through a mall and, you know, you would do a transaction in one place and then, you know, as you walked by other stores elsewhere in the mall, you could be offered, you know, targeted advertising, and they might even phone you up on the phone as you walk past and tell you, you know, that the pizzas were on sale or whatever it was they thought was of interest to you. So, you know, I started to think about that, and I was really, my mind was boggled, and then I realized that actually, it wasn't just Bluetooth that had been designed. You see, I started to see that the Bluetooth phone is a beacon, a public beacon for you as an individual. And when I was at that conference, I was sort of just wanting to walk around in a fairly private, low-key way. I didn't want to be broadcasting a beacon. And similarly, when I'm in the shopping center, I don't want to be broadcasting a beacon and be trackable and have people bombarding me with messages and spam. And then I started to realize, well, my goodness, our computers are the same way. The Ethernet connection, the wireless connection in your computer is also broadcasting a beacon. So we've actually, by not thinking about this, developed the whole technology of the century, such that it's based on this erroneous premise that individuals are public entities and beacons. And all of that has to be fixed, which is good. There's lots of jobs for your children. No problem. Meanwhile, we should start to work on, in our identity system, that for this missing layer, it has to be able to support two kinds of identity for the individual. One is sort of private identities that are just me to Amazon or me to the New York Times. And me to Amazon has nothing to do with me to the New York Times. And I don't want them put together into a nice folder. I don't want my articles that I read at the New York Times shared with the Wall Street Journal. I don't want all of that sold to Google so that they can now know what Tim Cameron at Microsoft is reading, and so on. So if you then take this into consideration, you're going to go, well, gee, there are different parts of my life where I want different things. So when I go to read the newspaper, I want privacy, and I don't want auditing, if you don't mind. Could you please turn that off? Meanwhile, when I go to my bank, I would like a bit of auditing. You know, I don't want people to be able to take money out of my account. Well, that's kind of preposterous. Put money into my account without me knowing who they were. So in one situation, I want one technology. In another situation, I want another one. And in different parts of my life, I want different operators. So, for example, when I'm dealing with government, I'll probably want a government identity provider. When I'm dealing with a bank, I'll want a financial identity provider. Will I want to use a government identity provider to deal with a bank? Some people may, but a lot of people probably won't. So if you want a system that has a lot of buy-in, you need to be able to separate those, and so on. So this leads us to the notion of pluralism of operators and technologies. And the other thing is that we have to integrate this with the human. I have a completely secure connection to a server in France, 10,000 miles away? However, I have a completely insecure connection between the computer and my head. Farming systems and spam systems and so on can intercept that. So what is the use of all of that security for the other 10,000 miles when this part is totally vulnerable? Now, how could something like that have been built, you ask yourself in retrospect? Well, the human wasn't taken into account as a part of the system. So we have to move from protocols to ceremonies. And we have to have a system that, even though it has these multiple technologies and multiple operators, is nonetheless easy for the human to use. It has to be consistent across these different things. So this leads us to the idea of an identity metasystem. And the computers in general have, the good news is this is not the first time we've had to build a metasystem. You can actually look at computing as a whole series of metasystems that have been added to the basic computer infrastructure. So, for example, we started, at one time, you had to choose between Ethernet, Token Ring, Frame Relay, X25. If you chose the wrong thing, you were out of here. Get out of here. At a certain point, we reached a stage where instead of having to make those technology decisions down at the level of which board you're using and make that sort of the basis of your whole future career, we could say, okay, you're going to bet on TCP/IP. And that's the bet you make, and then you can change what goes underneath it, and none of your systems change. You can do it incrementally, and so on. So that was the example. That was an example of bringing in a meta system, rather than us having to work at this very low layer. But you've seen the same thing around disk drives, for example. In the early days of computing, if you wrote a program, you had to know which kind of disk drive you had, how many sectors it had, blah, blah, blah. So that meant that if I wanted to buy a new disk drive, I had to actually read my manual of my software and decide whether that software would support the disk drive. And so even though my friend would come out with a really fabulous disk drive, I couldn't install that in the computer because none of my software would support it. Then one day we developed this meta system layer, which we called a device driver. So now the programs just wrote to the device driver, and the device driver took care of translating that to the individual disk drives. All right, and that allowed this whole new era of evolution of storage, where we could go to hundreds of gigabytes for a few hundred dollars, from the case where we were paying thousands of dollars for just a few megabytes. So if you think about display drivers and everything else, it's all the same. And we have to do what we've done in all those other areas of computing for identity. And if we do that, we now can have this system that reaches across business environments in the same way that the internet and the web reach across business environments. At that point, we'll have a framework for e-commerce, e-government, and the virtual world. Just to clarify the vocabulary, there are three parties: identity providers who issue the claims, subjects about whom they're made, relying parties who depend on them. And a given party can be in more than one role. So for example, a simple case is Visa makes a claim about Kim, which is depended on by Amazon, so they're all separate. But you could also have Kim makes a claim about Kim, which is depended on by Amazon. So that's what happens when you go now to a website and fill out a form. You make the claim about yourself. So you can see that both of these parties could be the same person. Similarly, Amazon might make a claim about Kim that is accepted at Amazon. So in that case, it's both the relying party and the identity provider. So you can be in more than one role at once. I'm going to skip over this. This is just to, I would like a hand of applause for my marketing department. So we've done we've talked about the identity meta system from the level of the technology looking up. Now let's talk about it from the point of the user looking down into the system. I don't really like the word abstraction that I've got on this slide. I would now rather call it a concretization. So basically, if you think about it, if you look at what an icon is, right, an icon for a file, well, in the old days, you used to copy a file, you would go copy a:\foo to c:\thisHurts. If you wanted to put it into a folder, you would say copy a:\foo into c:\whatis\thisHurtsMore. And so on. At a certain point, you would take your secretary and you would get her to try and figure this out, and it would take 6 months. And at the end, your files would all end up in one folder. So one day we then had the idea of using an icon, a physical picture of a file, a physical picture of a folder. And by doing that, we were able to get to the point that anybody could copy a file, put a file in a folder, and manipulate all of this stuff. Now, the file is itself just a stream of bits, and the folder is just a doubly linked list. So when you put a stream of bits into a pointer to a stream of bits into a doubly linked list, that's what you're doing when you drag a file into a folder. But my mother doesn't need to know about the doubly linked list or the stream of bits. From her point of view, all she's doing is moving one representation into another representation, and they both look perfectly real to her. So what we've been doing at Microsoft is to try and work with the rest of the industry to build a system that allows the same kind of visualization and abstraction of this meta system underneath, so that people can ordinary people can visualize and manipulate their identity relations just as they can now visualize and manipulate their files. By way of just so you'll know, this is not like futuristic goop. The system that embodies these notions is shipping in Windows Vista and will also run on Windows XP. And all of the notions in it and so on have been shared with the industry as a whole, so you're going to see exactly compatible and interworking versions of this that run on Linux and all the other systems. So with that, I'm just going to give you a very short demo. So I'm told this is going to work. I don't see... Oh, yeah, here we are. We're going to see an example of lack of proper communication to the user here. This is a "you must click on this for no reason" dialogue. Just intended to make me ignore, teach me how to ignore all security messages. Okay. Seems like that person missed law 6A. So here is a mock-up of Amazon.com, and you'll notice it's got its normal login page, but it also has this new concept of the information card. So the information card are these visualizations of your identity relationships. And once again, just like the file icon doesn't contain the information, it's just a pointer to a stream of bits. These visual representations don't contain any information. They're just pointers to your identity providers. So I'm going to decide to use an information card, and what will happen is my palette of identities will appear to me. And the ones that meet the policy requirements of the site I'm visiting are illuminated. The other ones are grayed out. So I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to use this one. I go and I send it to the site, and now I'm logged in. So I've actually done an identity exchange. I realized who gave me that card. I actually made it up myself. You know, I put the sports card on it because I'm, you know, such a hip guy, and blah, blah, blah. So now I want to proceed to the checkout because I bought something. And again, I want to use an information card. Up comes we call this the card space. So it's the thing that holds these visualizations of your identities. And in this case, the site has told me, okay, now we're down to doing a real identity transaction. So here is a Visa card. I will only accept Visa cards. So all the other cards are grayed out. Now I decide I'm going to proceed, so I submit with my Visa card this time. So now the identity relationship is to go out to Visa and get some information back that can be given to Amazon. In this case, because it goes to Visa specifically for that transaction, it doesn't release my credit card number. It releases a one-time transaction number that Visa can, that Amazon can use. So I have not given away a secret, right? If I went to Bamazon instead of Amazon, and Bamazon was able to trick my interfaces, and there are many reasons why that would be very, very, very hard, all they would get is a one-time secret encrypted for Amazon, and they wouldn't even be able to decrypt it to use it. So that's the general notion. I've tried to compress a lot. We're moving towards a world of claims. The claims can move around in this meta system. People can build components of the meta system on any device, on computers, on mobile phones, on iPods. They can send any kind of claims. The first instance of this is shipping within 6 months, it's built on the theory in the Laws of Identity, which you can read on my identity blog site. And thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.